You're listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners. To donate, click on the Canada Helps button or go to westhill.net/donate.
Thank you. Today we're carrying on with our Academy Award series, having skipped last week as we had our guests with us, helping us come to have a more personal understanding of what the Palestinian experience is. And it was wonderful to have that brought into this space so that we could engage it. But today we're looking at Argo, one of the nominees for Best Picture, and we're fitting it into our series on conversation. So my thoughts on it are so wide-ranging that I have papers back here that I'm going to refer to from time to time. And there's a lot going on in this. Not in the movie necessarily, though there's tons going on in the movie, but in the concept of conversation as I came to finally engage it when looking at this movie. I'm going to run you through the concept of the important things about conversation that we've been looking at, picked up from the book Difficult Conversations, written by Harvard negotiators who bring the whole art of mediation to the table in so many different contexts because of the wonderful work that they have done. But the idea of these difficult conversations that they place before us, that it's fairly easy to grasp, particularly when I repeat it over and over every week, I'm finally starting to learn some of this stuff. But it's that there are three conversations taking place at any given time when we're having a difficult conversation. And by that I'm not saying, you know, it's, you know, past the pepper or the salt. It's a difficult conversation that we're talking about. And there's three things going on there which we're generally oblivious to. The first one is the conversation about what really happened. How did we get in this situation? What went wrong? Who did what? We have three things going on in that, and the who did what is part of it, because I'm going to tell you who did what. I have a perfect perspective on that, so I'm going to share that with you, and perhaps a little loudly. And you have your perception of what happened, and you're going to share that with me, perhaps loudly, and this is how the conversations begin to break down. But there's so many other ways they can break down, too. We also go into the blame game, because obviously if I have an idea that you did something wrong, I'm looking to blame you. And really, can I do that? Well, yes, I can. I'm going to do that. And so the conversation continues to deteriorate. And then I'm blaming you because I know exactly what you were trying to do. You were trying to get me back for something I did 2 weeks ago, or you were trying to undermine my authority, or you were trying to steal the spotlight from me, whatever. I know what your intentions were. And of course, the conversation continues to disintegrate. Because in truth, we can't have all the truth ourselves. We don't know what someone else is intending. And blame is always contributed to by everyone engaged. And sometimes even by people who have no idea that they were even part of what went on in the situation. So what really happened is far more complex than we actually think. The next conversation that never takes place, when conversations are falling apart, is how I'm feeling about it. I don't tell you that I'm angry. I don't tell you that I'm mad. I don't tell you that I was hurt. I don't tell you that you've broken my trust in you and I'm afraid. I don't tell you all of those things. And so how can we possibly have a conversation? We can only have those difficult conversations if we're upfront about how we feel, if we identify what our feelings are. And that's a very scary thing to do. So saying, I'm scared about telling you this, and disclosing our feelings helps that conversation get back on an even footing. So that's the what's it's happening and what your feelings are. And the last one is, who am I in this conversation? What does it mean if I made this mistake? What does it mean if you did this to me? Who am I in that conversation? Am I someone you love? Am I someone you are trying to hurt? Am I someone who can't stand up for herself? Am I someone who is just nasty? Figuring out what we think about ourselves is going on as those conversations are happening. And so if we don't own that that's happening and have an idea of what it is that we're thinking as we're taking part in that conversation, we get derailed by all of that. So with all that in front of us, any of it going wrong and being totally oblivious to whatever it is, it's no wonder that those difficult conversations get extraordinarily difficult. But this movie didn't deal with difficult conversations like that. No one went and said, you know, we've got these six people in the embassy and I just want to talk to you about how they got there and why they're there and how we really need you to let them go. Because those conversations would have been far too threatening. So the conversations that took place inside the house, inside the embassy. They took place between the CIA and the U.S. embassy and the Canadian embassy and the Brits sometimes. They took place between President Carter and Iran in totally unscripted ways. Sometimes Carter standing up and saying things that triggered incredible reactions in other parts of the globe. The conversations never took place cleanly because it wasn't safe for them to take place cleanly. Now we know the storyline, those of you who have seen the movie, and I'm going to have Joanne play the trailer just to sort of bring it back crystally into your head, and then we'll carry on a little bit about the plot and what was just happening in the movie and in reality. There are those who think that the reason Ben Affleck wasn't nominated for an Academy Award as Best Director was because he flashed that six-pack in the middle of the movies. One of the highlights for me. But the movie is an incredible step along Ben Affleck's journey as a producer. He's had some horrible movies, but the last few have been fairly good, and this one is one of them. One of the reasons that when Carter says the whole world is shocked that this has happened in Iran and that the hostages have been taken, one of the reasons that the world was shocked was because Carter was only getting information from people who were getting information from the Shah's people. They weren't actually doing any of their own espionage, if you might call it that, to try to get information about what was really going on. And so while the Canadian embassy with Ken Taylor was very aware of what was happening in Iran and recognized the signs of revolution coming long before it actually happened, the American embassy was totally oblivious to it because they were not getting their own direct information but were merely taking information from the sources that they had within the Shah's regime. And so when things fell apart suddenly and created the situation where hostages were taken and these people who are depicted in the movie fled and managed to find their way eventually to the Canadian embassy, they weren't all there to begin with, it was a shock to the Americans, who had continued to support the Shah during some of the most egregious human rights abuses that had been recorded in that country. And so when they gave him safe harbor and allowed him to come to the United States, that was what enraged the Iranians so completely that they overtook the embassy and created the scenario that unfolded for hundreds and hundreds of days. Fortunately, not so for these who were at the Canadian embassy. Ken Taylor was a fairly young diplomat. His wife, Pat, a very successful and well-known, world-renowned scholar in scientific research, who worked there in the blood clinic. When they took them into their home, they recognized and knew that this is a step that could cost them their lives. And so the conversations then became very, very careful. Who would know what, how much they would know, what you could do, where you could do it, how people would be, was very carefully managed during that time. And it was only because of the wisdom and the wits of those who were caring for the six that they did make it out safely. Now, the story is dramatized, obviously. There were several other options available to them, including the Canadians really felt that they should pose as teachers who were offering teaching or who were doing some studies over there. But this story about the Hollywood movie seemed to be the most engaging. And Carter eventually said, don't give them options. Just tell them which one you're going to go for. And this is the story that they went for. Carter recognized that the stress about trying to decide whether or not I was going to pretend I was a teacher or whatever would be more than these people already horrifically stressed could take. And so the story of the fake movie unfolded and took place and was a very successful result. I read the whole book, Our Man in Tehran, in order to get my head around this movie, Robert Wright's historical documentation of the events that led up to this situation and what it was that the Canadians did. I read a lot about it, trying to get a bit of an idea of where I could go with this movie, which seems so contradictory to the conversations, difficult conversations journey that we were doing over the course of these few weeks. I learned things like they were fudging the numbers early on. No one really wanted to say to the media how many hostages there were. And a few very astute journalists realized that they were fudging the numbers and so started to guess, to the point that eventually there was news that, and journalists had to be called in and the news broken to them and then asked, please don't break this news, which they didn't. But people would come up to Flora MacDonald, who was our minister, foreign affairs minister at the time, and say, so how are our guests, in the middle of a cocktail party? And the fear was always that someone would leak it, that the news would get into the wrong hands, that someone would find out that those people were there. And the tragedy of that, well, we can all imagine what that would have been. But reading that history book and not finding an inspirational moment in it or a reflection that might have taken us somewhere gave me a lot of information about the situation that was as it was going, but it didn't clear up for me where to go in this perspective, in this understanding of that movie, until I finally realized what it was. It was about conversations with the enemy. Conversations with the enemy is what this movie, in our conversation about conversations, that's what it was about. How we have enemies in our world, and how do we have these difficult conversations with them? Do we really just go out there and, you know, say, okay, this is what I think you did, and this is what I think I did, and so I'm contributing to that, and I think your intentions were this, to take over my people and enslave us all, and my intentions were that, and I'm not trying to blame you because I know I've got some, but we don't do that with our enemies. If we do that with our enemies, we put ourselves at incredible risk. And I recognized during the sharing time that I was talking about doing just that and trying to be present to people who step into those very difficult conversations with those who are their enemies. We think about enemies on a global scale often. What was going on in Iran at that time and what goes on in so many different parts of the world, we think about those people as enemies. That our faith tradition says that we have to love our enemies, and individually maybe you can. You know that song that Lennon sang about, no, it wasn't Lennon, it was Sting, sang about the people in Russia loving their children too. We, on an individual basis, we can love our enemies, but when we see them as a block, it's pretty darn hard. When we see them as a massive nationalistic fervor that wants to obliterate our way of life, then we have difficulty with it. Or if we see them as a huge group of people that are oppressing an entire identity within their own culture, then we see them as the enemy to that. It's hard to have conversations with those people. And so diplomacy is what has been developed. And the quote that you saw on the slide, which I don't have in front of me, but it's about how you send a man of virtue to go and live somewhere else and lie to the people there. Diplomacy is about lying, isn't it? It's about not telling the truth. It's about hiding what it is that you know and sharing little bits and pieces that you might choose to share, but never really telling the whole truth because things are at stake. And the reading that Elaine shared is about how that used to be an ongoing conversation as people traveled and spent years in other countries and got to know the culture and the identity of the people and shared on a deep, well-embedded way. But we now have these G20s and G8s where people come together and there's this sort of instant diplomacy that happens, and the illusion obviously is to marriage, where you come together periodically and have great times, and the rest of the time it's just kind of you don't talk to each other. That kind of diplomacy isn't really working in our world often, and there's not much that we can take from it as a way that we need to have conversations in our own personal life without really wondering if that's helpful or if it isn't better to go back to the difficult conversations model and be a little more honest. But diplomacy does offer us some clues, and I'm going to take a leap here and talk about some of the other things that are happening this week. Because diplomacy, when you're living with the enemy, is important. And here I'm talking about the experience of people who are in abusive relationships, who live with someone who is consistently abusive to them, degrades them, denies them their rights, prevents them from having friends or going out, is constantly suspicious, eradicates the person's sense of self-worth, constantly undermining it and attacking it at every point. Emotional abuse is just as horrific as physical abuse, the scars sometimes lasting far longer than those of physical abuse. And this week, on Thursday, Valentine's Day, there's a whole group that's coming together, a whole movement that's happening, that's spurred on by Eve Ensler of the Vagina Dialogues, monologues, who talks about rape and about abuse in a very public way. Before I go to that, though, I want to talk about what we need to do when we hear that someone is in an abusive relationship or recognize that we ourselves are. And that is, be attentive to what is going on in that relationship, whether it's your own or someone else's. And don't look away. If it's your own relationship and you've woken up to the fact that it's abusive, stay awake. Don't go back to sleep. And if it's someone else's, you might say that to them. Stay awake. Don't go back to sleep. But people who are in abusive relationships are in very risky situations. And one of the first things that you need to do is make sure that they know a way to safety, whether that's to your house, or whether that's a phone number that they can call, or whether it's a shelter that they can get to. Making sure that they have a mental plan, even if they are still saying to you, I know it's fine, I'm going to cope, it's all right. Just inviting them to make sure they have a mental plan. That's an extremely important step for that individual. Because once they've got a mental plan, the possibility that they will actually act it out is much higher than if they never think their way through to freedom from that abusive relationship. The conversations that people can have within an abusive relationship are not conversations that are going to make things better, unless there is conversation taking place with significant therapists outside of the relationship. No one who is being abused, male or female, in a hetero relationship or a homosexual relationship, no one is going to go to the person who is abusing them and just convince them that it's wrong. That's far too risky and it's very dangerous. So helping them to find that they need some support beyond the relationship is an extremely important thing, rather than saying, well, why don't you just go home and talk it out? I'm sure you'll convince her or him that it's not that bad and that they can stop. Always being open to listening, always being open to offering resources, never suggesting that the person can fix it on their own, and never, ever suggesting that you can fix it for them. These are all just little points of light that you're offering that person may pick up on. Sleeping with the Enemy is a movie that was made in 1991 with Julia Roberts, and I don't recommend her Ultimate Solution. But it did raise the issue, as if Farrah Fawcett's The Burning Bed, raise the issue of abuse within domestic relationships and help us to understand that it was far more widespread than we thought. But the 1 Billion Rising movement helps us understand that it's even more widespread than that, than those instances that are graphic and catch our attention and are turned into Hollywood movies. But that 1 in 3 women of the total world population will either be raped or beaten during her lifetime. I'm one of those women. And I bet there are women in this community that are also one of those women. And so for me, it's a very personal thing. But it also gives me a commitment to be present when someone else comes to me and has that same kind of experience as well. And so I'm not ashamed of saying that I'm one of those women, although for many, many, many years I was. I'm going to share with you some of the words written by Eve Ensler about this 1 Billion Rising movement. I'm actually editing them because there's some stuff in them that I think is a little too graphic. But in anticipation of where we were going today, I've already sent links to our webmaster to have them put on our website so that you can find other videos that were too graphic. One called 1,000 Women Fall Down the Stairs Every Day, and other videos on the 1 Billion Rising website. So I encourage you to look for those. But here are the words that that Eventler has given this movement. On the webpage, the 1 Billion Rising webpage, you see these words. 1 in 3 women on the planet will be raped or beaten in her lifetime. 1 billion women violated is an atrocity. 1 billion women dancing is a revolution. And that's what the 1 billion Rising is about. It's a movement to mark on Valentine's Day to have 1 billion women dancing around the world. And we're going to show you that video later. But this is the poem that Eve Ensler has written. And for some of you who think that poetry is just a sweet and lovely thing, this will jar your understanding of poetry. It's called Over It. I am over rape. I am over rape culture, rape mentality, rape pages on Facebook. I am over the thousands of people who signed those pages with their real names without shame. I am over people calling it freedom of speech and justifying it as a joke. I am over people not understanding that rape is not a joke, and I am over being told I don't have a sense of humor, and women don't have a sense of humor. I am over how long it takes for anyone to ever respond to rape. I am over the hundreds of thousands of women in Congo still waiting for the rapes to end and the rapists to be held accountable. I am over the thousands of women in Bosnia, Burma, Syria, Somalia, Pakistan, South Africa, Guatemala, Sierra Leone, Haiti, Afghanistan, Libya, you name a place, still waiting for justice. I am over rape happening in broad daylight. I am over a woman being gang raped and murdered on a bus in Delhi or gang raped and videoed in Steubenville, Ohio. I am over 1 in 3 women in the military, U.S. military, getting raped by their so-called comrades. I am over the forces that deny women who have been raped the right to have an abortion. I am over rape victims becoming re-raped when they try to prosecute their cases. I am over women still being silent about rape because they are made to believe it's their fault or they did something to make it happen. I am over violence against women not being a number one international priority when 1 out of 3 women will be raped or beaten in her lifetime. The destruction and muting and undermining of women is the destruction of life itself. No women, no future, duh. I am over this rape culture where the privileged with political and physical and economic might take what and who they want, when they want it, as much as they want, anytime they want it. I am over the endless resurrection of the careers of rapists and sexual exploiters, film directors, world leaders, corporate executives, movie stars, athletes, while the lives of the women they violated are permanently destroyed, often forcing them to live in social and emotional exile. I am over the passivity of good men. Where the hell are you? You live with us, make love with us, father us, befriend us, brother us, get nurtured and mothered and eternally supported by us. So why aren't you standing with us? Why are you driven to the point of madness and action by the rape and humiliation of us? I am over years and years of being over rape and thinking about rape every day of my life since I was 5 years old and getting sick from rape and depressed from rape and enraged by rape. And reading my insanely crowded inbox of rape horror stories every hour of every single day. I am over being polite about rape. It's been too long now. We have been too understanding. We need to end rape in every school, park, radio, bus, TV station, household, office, factory, refugee camp, military base, back room, nightclub, alleyway. We need people to truly try and imagine once and for all what it feels like to have your body invaded, your mind splintered, your soul shattered. We need you to let our rage and our compassion connect us together so we can change the paradigm of global rape. There are approximately 1 billion women on the planet who have been violated. 1 billion women. The time is now. 1 billion women are rising today to end rape because we are over it. Carrie, can you put the video on? This is the video of the dance from the 1 Billion Rising movement. give you a little more insight about the One Billion Rising movement. There are places all over the world and women all around the world who have been learning via YouTube the choreography of the dance that you're going to see that goes to the song that is the theme song of One Billion Rising. And there are events that are planned to bring women together. So it's a very inspirational moment and time for people to do that. And they're doing it on Valentine's Day, which is called V-Day, for reasons that are obvious, coming from Eve Ensler. And here's the video called Break the Chain. Breaking the chain is obviously one of the big things that has to happen. And this program, I think, is merely to break the isolation chain, because women who are in abusive relationships or women who have been raped often isolate themselves completely from communities that could support and care for them because of the shame involved in that. So breaking that silence is a significant part of the piece of work, and I think bringing women together in this very physical, very upbeat way is an important part of breaking that silence. I learned just not that long ago about a woman who felt that in order to be able to leave the person that was abusing her, she had to actually egg him on to beat her up so that she could call the police and then be able to begin the process of divorce. When we are still in this country that unaware of how to get about being free of that kind of violence, we still haven't said enough to open it up. So there's the conversation with the enemy on a global scale, and conversation with the enemy in relationship. But what about that conversation when the enemy is yourself? When you continue to undermine your own strength, when you continue to fall short of your own dreams, when you continue to undermine the voice that you might share out into the world. And I'm going to focus for the next little while on the work by Melody Beatty. Many of you will know Melody Beatty. Had her book published after having it rejected by something like 20 publishers, finally in 1987, Codependent No More was published by Hazelden, which is a publisher that that has grown out of its work and experience in addictions and counseling work. And so they finally published her book, which has now sold something like 80 million copies. And she has continued to write for many, 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 many books that have been helpful to many people since that time. The idea of codependency brought together the thinking, psychological thinking of a number of scholars, but put it together in a book that people could relate to. They could understand what it meant, because there were examples that were talking about how they lived and what they were doing within their own relationships that were undermining who they were. When we're codependent, I would say the conversations that we're having are conversations with ourselves, our conversations as with an enemy, because we aren't being really honest. We're being diplomatic with ourselves until we can, as diplomacy happens, until we can perhaps find the way to those deeper truths. And so looking at Beatty's work over the past few days to get a sense of what codependency was and recognizing that it, as so many have recognized, is based on a 12-step program that recognizes there's something greater than ourselves. And when we talk about something greater than ourselves, we talk about those values. Some of you still use the concept God. Some of you have always used a concept of love. It doesn't matter what that concept is. It's that we see that beyond us there's something greater. And Beatty helped people recognize that beyond the way that they had defined their own relationship, there was a deeper, richer relationship that they could have with themselves first before they started taking it into the relationships that they had with other people. I printed up a few copies of the checklist for codependency that Beatty puts in her book, and there's five of them out in the lobby. But again, that's another link that I've put on the website. She asks you to rate each thing, whether it's a zero for this never happens, to a one, to sometimes, to two all the time, to determine how deeply codependent you are. But that may also be how deeply addicted you are to a variety of different things, not just codependent relationship. And so the conversation that we have with ourselves, if we're never truthful, we never get beyond that sort of diplomacy stage. We never get into a deep honesty with ourselves that can help us understand ourselves and see our way through to a future. And to that, I look to Beattie's latest book, which was published last year, called Make Miracles in 40 Days or something like that. Now, Beattie argues that miracles come about in ways that aren't just divinely, supernaturally created. She argues that we can make our own miracles, even though she uses the Bible to show scripture passages that say we can. So I'm not really sure what her background about that is and whether she actually thinks she has to do that or whether she was actually trying to take her message to a broader audience that might have avoided it if it wasn't grounded in Christian precepts. But her basic premise is very, very simple. And it's that we have to get honest with ourselves. She starts you off and says, do this for 40 days. And you know, if you don't get a miracle in 40 days, keep doing it. Because miracles don't come on a base, on a timeline. And what she means by miracles is some kind of change in your attitude, in your perception that opens you to different possibilities. Jerome Stone would call them those situationally transcendent resources, which I often refer to, that in the movie, those six locked up in the basement from time to time or always within the confines of that house, they had no way did they have the resources to get themselves out of that. So the miracle or the situationally transcendent resources were the things that were going on, that were happening outside, that were making it possible for them to be saved. At any moment in time, we have all kinds of things that we can do for ourselves and way more that we can never access on our own. And those are the situationally transcendent resources that Stone speaks of, or the miracles that Melody Beattie talks about. But the exercise that she gives you for each of those 40 days, and it's interesting that, you know, the 40 days of Lent start this week, and although I don't traditionally follow them, these 40 days is an interesting principle in this study that she has offered in the book, is that you sit down as quickly as you can, as close as you can to getting up in the morning, and you write down, I am thankful that. And then you don't write down, I have a nice house, and I've got a nice car, and my kids are lovely to me, and, you know, my two-year-old never really connected every time he tried to hit me. You don't write those things down. The things that you write down are, I'm thankful that, and then you end it with those things that are terrible in your life. You're not saying you're thankful for them. You're saying you're thankful that. So, I'm thankful that I am really angry at my mother right now. I made that up, Mom, in case you're watching. But you say, I'm really thankful that I'm stuck in my house because I'm sick and I can't get out. I'm really thankful that I have kids that never phone me. I'm really thankful that they have my name on a list of people that are no longer able to get credit because of what happened the last 5 years. I'm really thankful that I'm furious that this is the situation. I'm really thankful that I'm frustrated that I don't have the power to change these things. You're right, I'm really thankful that. And all that stuff that you normally never admit to yourself. And Beattie's argument is that once we start admitting these things to ourselves, once we start getting all that dirty laundry out on a piece of paper every morning, and she also suggests that you do it in a buddy system, because that can be very helpful. But getting all of that out and looking at it is an important part of understanding who you really are. And when you understand who you really are, then you're far more likely to see what your limitations are and to be able to open yourself to accessing those situationally transcendent resources that are beyond you. You have much better ability to function in a group as the whole of you, who you are, when you know who you are, than you have when you're not. You have a much better ability to ask for something that you need when you know you need it, rather than just being, you know, silently bitter that you never got that to begin with, or somebody didn't give it to you and you have to ask for it, because you're never aware that that's really happened. Beattie says, get that out on paper. Even if you write the same list of things, I'm really thankful that, for 90 days instead of 40, you're going through that process of coming to know who you are. And that's one of the most important processes that any of us can undertake in our lives. So if Beattie's got a little trick that works in helping that, then maybe it's worth following. The conversation about being codependent that started Beattie on this track is a conversation that we could all look at. I was amused when I looked at some of her lists, and this is 7 pages I printed out of things that could or could not be. But here are the ones on communication, poor communication that codependents have. Blame, threaten, coerce, beg, bribe, advise. And then these are the ones that get confusing. Codependents may not say what they mean, may not mean what they say, may not know what they mean, may not take themselves seriously, may think other people don't take themselves seriously, may take themselves too seriously. It goes on and on. It's complex and confusing. And every one of us, if we looked at it, could probably tick off an awful lot of those things and not be sure which ones were really problems and which ones weren't. But I think the biggest problem in these conversations with the enemy, on a global scale, on a relationship scale, on a personal, internal scale, I think the biggest problem is not knowing who we are. If we don't know what our goals are on a global scale, if we don't know who we are, if we don't know who we can trust, then those conversations are very dangerous and we need to be careful. If we don't know who we are in our personal relationships, and not just relationships that are abusive, though I focused on them because of what's happening this coming week, but in all our relationships, if we don't know who we really are, how can that person love us completely if we're not letting them know who we are, if we're hiding whole parts of ourselves? And if we don't know ourselves, how on earth are we possibly going to know where we need to go or what we need to do or what it is we really want or what our goals might be? I think that conversations with the enemy sometimes rule our lives. And it's only when we really come to see we are not our own enemies, when we really live into the truth of that and take some guidance from whatever places they can come, that we can get beyond the limitations that we have and open ourselves truly to what the world might offer us, what possibilities might be there, what infinite potential there is in our lives. And I think that's gift. So Argo, as a movie, took me to look at what conversations with enemies are all about. And I consider that a gift, as well as the many other resources that I enjoyed as I studied this movie. I hope that you go from watching Argo or from this perspective, wrap it with your own understanding, analyze your own relationships and your relationship with yourself, and maybe read the paper differently as you think about diplomacy and conversations with our enemies, and find your way into the world as you really are, instead of as you pretend to be, completely locking away those truths about yourselves that are a little too ugly to share with the neighbors. They have to be shared with you. So be bold about that. Share deeply and richly, and watch as the effects of that are seen in the relationships beyond you and out into the world. Thank you.